Continuing with chapter 4. Canto 2, the process of creation. Texts 3 and 4. Because yesterday we discussed text 2. 3 and 4 are grouped together. The scene, the storyline is Maharaj Parikshit has presented his initial questions, Canto 1. Canto 2, Shukadeva Goswami answers those two questions. What is the duty of a person in general? And specifically, what is the duty of the person who's about to die and they know it? What are they to do? And second question is, what is that subject matter that one should hear about, speak, remember, and become absorbed in general, and when you're about to die? Those questions have been answered in sequence, forming a God conception and detachment from material sense gratification. Maturing, leaving that behind when that becomes well established, fixing the mind upon the form of the Lord within the heart in a spirit of detachment from sense gratification. And graduating from that, or the mature stage of that, is engaging fully in devotional service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, assisted by the hearing of the topics of Krishna Katha and conducting one's life in that manner, more and more absorbed in concentration of the mind upon the Personality of Godhead and full engagement in loving service to the Personality of Godhead, thus being the consummate stage of detachment. And then he summarizes in a variety of ways, concluding, now I've answered your questions, like Bhagavatam class is over. And chapter 4 opens with Maharaj Parikshit assimilating, the steps of assimilation, just like Shrinvanti, Gayanti, Grinanti, Sadhavaha, to take that message within and let it become fully assimilated or situated in the seat of consciousness within the heart. So there's some stages of his absorbing that message that are described. First one, to the exclusion of any other thought, Maharaj Parikshit fixed his mind upon the Personality of Godhead. The verse yesterday was he completely detached any consideration or sense of attachment to the worldly things, the mine category. What is mine? And now, this verse is about the means or process. So, self-identity, the sense of who I am, and the sense of what is mine, they're intimately connected. I and mine. And now this is, what do I, in that spiritual conception of life, do? And conversely, what do I not do? So, it starts with conception, and then following conception is actions flow, or the real quality of the soul is being exhibited here in these verses 3 and 4. And it's very instructive for us in the practice stage. This is where we want to go to. So, translation. The purport is 3 pages long. Nice purport. Oh, great sages. So the person speaking is Sutta. Sutta is saying to the sages of Naimisharanya, after Maharaj Parikshit received Shukadeva Goswami, he presented his questions, he heard his answers. Here's what he did. Because they asked, what did he do? What happened next? The great soul, Maharaj Parikshit, constantly wrapped in thought of Lord Krishna, knowing well of his imminent death. What did he do? He renounced all sorts of fruitive activities, namely acts of religion, economic development, and sense gratification, and thus fixed himself firmly in his natural love for Krishna, and asked all these questions. All these questions are questions he's going to ask next, coming up, exactly as you are asking me. So his spirit of inquisitiveness, he knows he's going to die. He has a perfect person in front of him to guide him expertly. He is qualified to perfectly understand and follow. So this is a momentous opportunity. And he's really keen to get the right answers to the right questions, and the sages are equally keen to follow this dialogue so they can also be guided by Sutta in disciplic succession. Packed in the verse is this message that fruitive activities, when we think of fruitive activities, we may think of a narrow idea of what fruitive activities may mean, you know, 9 to 5. What happens in your career, 9 to 5, that's fruitive activities. This is a much broader definition. The broader definition is dharma artha kama, in the sense that even dharma, like, you know, religious functions that people go to, if the motivation of those attendance to those religious functions is economic prosperity or fulfillment of desires of some type or another, may my son and daughter have a wonderful marriage. You know, you engage in some sangskar, and so it's religious, but it's with fruitive intention. Or I'm about to embark on a major enterprise, so to make an auspicious ceremony is conducted, or all those, you know, what all those rituals are. So somebody gets into a car, and you have a Brahmin come and bless the car, and pay for the ritual, and you've got all these marks all over the car, and then you've got a blessed car. Something, you know, there's so many varieties of rituals. That's falling in the category of fruitive activity, if the consciousness behind those activities is with fruitive intention, artha. And the purpose behind the artha is kama. So without, he's setting aside materially motivated activities. And because he's setting aside the consciousness that drives those materially motivated activities. And he has the qualification to do that. We're going to hear repeated 3 times in the purport, what is the qualification to do that? Or go the other direction. If one doesn't have that qualification, what is one to do? So the Bhagavatam is giving us the instruction how to develop that qualification, just like last night the how-to question was asked by Arjuna. How does one go beyond the conditioning influences of the modes of material nature? So this isn't just how-to. Here's the exemplar, Maharishi Pariksit. He's done it. And now here's what he does after he's done it. He's still doing something. Purport. Three-page purport by Srila Prabhupada. The three activities of religion, economic development, and sensual gratification are generally very attractive for conditioned souls struggling for existence in the material world. Such regulated activities prescribed in the Vedas are called the karma kandiya conception of life, and householders are generally recommended to follow the rules just to enjoy material prosperity both in this life and the next. Most people are attracted by such activities. Not only they're attracted by what comes from those activities, they're attracted to the activities of karmakandiya. Even in the activities of their modern godless civilization, people are more concerned with economic development and sense gratification without religious sentiments. So, I'm going to share with you a little sub-discussion that took place last night after the class on the understanding these stages that are described in Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, where Krishna says, this is what you should do. If you can't do that, do this. If you can't do that, do this. If you can't do that, do this. And then knowledge is better. Better than that is meditation. Better than that is renunciation of the fruits of work, because in that condition one can achieve peace. We had that discussion. It connects to this, so we'll cover it. The sentence that Prabhupada just spoke is the situation of society today. People have no regard for Dharma, but they do have regard for economic prosperity. And the reason they have regard for economic prosperity is sense gratification. And the hallmark of that mad pursuit for sense gratification is our Western, sometimes called culture. The culture of no culture is economic prosperity by hook or by crook. Whoops, do it nicely. Don't get caught. And quietly, by hook or by crook, prosper so that you can have sense gratification. So that's uncivilized. And so this sequence in Bhagavad Gita is better than that. Is the cultivation of knowledge. Now, I gave the example to the devotees that were asking this question of one man that's been coming to our Brooklyn temple, Radha Govinda Mandir, for 15 years or more. And even when, you know, the deities have moved from one place to another, he follows where the deities are. And it's not because he's attracted to the deities, he's just attracted to, well, frankly, he's attracted to prasadam. And he comes with his paper bag, you know, those ones with the rope handles. And it's a big kind of paper bag. And inside his paper bag, he's got all kinds of books. So he comes to RT and he sits down in a chair and he reads his books. And then class is going on and he's reading his books. And then everybody goes downstairs for prasadam, and he goes downstairs for prasadam, he's reading his books. And he takes prasadam, and if there's extra prasadam, he has his plastic containers, and he fills up his plastic. He's very polite, he doesn't, you know, it's only when there's something left over so it doesn't get thrown out, and he fills up his plastic containers and walks out the door reading his books. Goes to the subway reading his books, and goes home and reads his books. He's cultivating knowledge. Knowledge of God knows what. It's not scripture, it's just cultivating knowledge. So that's better than just unabashed fruitive work. Above that is meditation. It's not specifically dhyan yoga, it's people that do meditation. You know, the generic yoga class where they do some kind of meditation. The conception of God is not necessarily there, quite frankly, it's usually not there, but some kind of meditation. And better than that is the religious kind of regulated work, karmakandya. So, vikarma, cultivation of knowledge, meditation, karma kanda, regulated fruitive activities. And above that is karma yoga, where regulated fruitive activities without, well, at least lessening material motivation, where some of the fruits of the one's work is offered to the Supreme, with sacrifice to the Supreme, karma yoga. And through that process, detachment from the fruits of work allow the emergence of a clearer intellect, where one can then not just cultivate knowledge, but go to the scriptures and try to pursue understanding the Supreme. Now we're in the yoga ladder stage of things, karma yoga to jnana yoga. And as one, we find this at the end of chapter 6 of Bhagavad Gita, the yoga ladder is described by Srila Prabhupada. When one's knowledge becomes fixed, then the concentration of the mind and intelligence upon the Supreme morphs or transforms into dhyana yoga, a more formal system of meditation upon the Supersoul within the heart. And from that dhyana yoga, we find at the end of chapter 6, Krishna says, the best of all forms of yoga is when the mind is fixed upon the Supreme with full activity, bhakti, from the root word bhaj, not the English word bhaj, but the Sanskrit word bhaj, indicating the senses being engaged in activities connected with sense objects, but put in a spirit of devotion. As in Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam, Bhaktir Uchate. So we just went through this whole string of steps from Vikarma to cultivation of knowledge, to meditation, to detachment from the fruits of work, Karma Kanda, to Karma Yoga, to Jnana Yoga, to Dhyana Yoga, to Bhakti Yoga. Where that fits in here to what's being described by Sutta Goswami about Maharaj Parikshit is that he's way up there. And we'll hear just a little bit more where it fits in. It fits in that he's giving up the karma kanda activities, even non-fruitively engaged in, because he's a devotee, king. Because he's a king, he, in Dwarpa Yuga, not in our present age, there's a different recommendation, but we'll find that Vedic kings, or kings during the Mahabharata era and prior, they set example for the citizens in general. They engaged in, or they engaged brahmanas in, the performance of various yajñas. Right? far as Yudhisthira and his Ashwamedha Yagyas and things like that, we don't find Pratap Rudra Maharaj doing those things because it's a different yuga. It's not, they're not qualified brahmanas to perform those yagyas, and the consciousness of people in general is such that were they to do such things, they wouldn't have the qualification to do them in Krishna consciousness, so it's not recommended. Besides, they're not going to be effective because the qualified brahmanas are not there. There's another process that was recommended. So the next sentence reads, as a great emperor of the world, Maharaj Parikshit had to observe such regulations in a Vedic Karma Kandiya section. He had to set example for the people in general. So he did such things, or at least made arrangements for such things. We find other examples of this in during the reign of Maharaj Ambarish. The description is there that he was so fabulously opulent that it surpassed the opulence of heaven, and he was completely detached. He didn't consider that opulence to be of more significance than pebble. One doesn't get excited about the driveway here is filled with pebbles. You don't go outside and think, ah, pebble. He wasn't excited about his opulence, but he used it in service to the Supreme Lord. And it further describes that there was, in some part of his kingdom, there was a drought. And so he engaged Gotama and other great rishis in some yajna that would counteract the effects of the drought. And sure enough, it rained. But what did he do? He was in his mandir, his royal palace, worshipping his Radha Krishna deity. But he was engaging the brahmanas in these karma kandiya yajnas. Because during that time, persons were of different faith. Even today, persons are of different faith. And there were qualified brahmanas to engage in those yajnas, and so it was done. And a contemporary example of that, same phenomena, is Srila Prabhupada's case, where when he brought Krishna consciousness to the West, he did not introduce Varnashram Dharma. He spoke about it as the means of organizing society, but he didn't emphasize it. There were vestiges of it here and there, like in the beginning. Men were wearing saffron, and then some ladies joined. Jadarani came and some other ladies, so Prabhupada considered boys and girls in the West, they're used to mixing, and so he did what was not done in India. He introduced the Brahmacharini ashram. There's no such ashram. But he introduced the Brahmacharini ashram, and Brahmacharinis wore saffron. Then after some time, the Brahmacharinis wore saris of multicolors, and the Brahmacharis wore saffron. And then, after some time, he understood the Brahmacharinis needed to have husbands, and the Brahmacharis weren't Naishtika Brahmacharis. They needed to become grihasthas. So then, introducing white. So gradually, it developed like that. And then, grihasthas lived in the ashram, wherever the ashram was. And then when there was wish to have children, that became a problem. So the grihasthas had to live outside, and then, you know, to live outside they had to have income, and so they had to, you know, take up a job. And it kind of evolved from the early phases. And then Prabhupada introduced sannyas, another ashram. The Varnaprastha ashram just kind of never made it. Everyone was a brahmachari or brahmacharini, and then it was grihastha and brahmachari and brahmacharini, and then it was sannyas, grihastha, and brahmachari, brahmacharini. And even the term brahmacharini seems to have, like, evaporated into non-existence. But this is in the West. And when Prabhupada went back to India, there wasn't a brahmachari ashram. There was no women in the ashram because the culture understood the appropriateness or inappropriateness of such a thing. In the West, Prabhupada accepted they didn't have that capacity of discrimination, and so he made that arrangement. But the distinction, the sharp distinction of these things was not strongly emphasized until Prabhupada during 1975 and particularly in 76, he began speaking about Daivi Varnashram and introducing Varnashram in his explanation. Catch this one, this is very important. Was because my disciples are not chanting their Gayatris, and because in some cases they're not even chanting their rounds, what is the Bhagavat Dharma principle depends upon the Shravanam Kirtanam process, and if the Shravanam Kirtanam process is not being adhered to, then we must introduce Varnashram. It's like the safety net. You're on a high wire. It's a very high position, but it's a long fall to go from, you know, this very elevated position of devotional service where one doesn't have the duties of varna and ashram. One just has hearing and chanting about Krishna, and the hearing and chanting about Krishna is being neglected. It's a long fall down. And Prabhupada saw some of his Western disciples take a nosedive off a cliff and splatter at the bottom, and it wasn't nice. So then he indicated we should introduce this Varnashram Dharma system within ISKCON. The safety net. At least do this. You can't do this. Do this, just like in Bhagavad Gita, 12th chapter. Fix your mind always upon me, engage your intelligence fully in me, and surely you will abide with me and be with me always. And if you can't do that, follow the regulations of Bhakti Yoga. And you'll come to that stage. And if you can't do that, try to work for me. Karma Yoga, giving up the fruits of your work. If you can't do that, cultivate knowledge. So Prabhupada went in that sequence. Now here we have Maharaj Parikshit, who as king, he's engaging in pure devotional service, but because he's king in a kingdom, the whole world, where not everybody is ready for pure devotional service, he observed Karmakanda rituals as king. But now he's about to die, and he's heard from Shukadeva Goswami, and he's had his association. So he's now giving up dharma, artha, and kama. And so the qualification to do so is he can fix his mind completely upon the personality of Godhead, which we're going to hear. So, once again, as a great emperor of the world, Maharaj Parikshit had to observe such regulations in the Vedic Karma Kandiya section, but by his slight association with Shukadeva Goswami, he could perfectly understand that Lord Krishna, the absolute personality of Godhead, Vasudev, for whom he had a natural love since birth, is everything. And thus, he fixed his mind firmly upon him, renouncing all modes of Vedic karma kandiya activities. So there's two qualifications. This Sanskrit word adhikar means qualification. So he had the qualification of knowledge and fixing his mind upon the absolute truth. So that's what we find in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. That's like the most recommended position, because the beginning of chapter 12, what does Arjuna ask? Krishna, can you please tell me clearly which is better for me, to worship you in your personal form or worship the impersonal teacher? He gives an unequivocal answer. Arjuna, what's best is worshiping my transcendental form. So, in text 9, he says, my dear Arjuna, O winner of wealth, just fix your mind upon me, text 8. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. There are these two subtle faculties, mind and intelligence, and both have to be in good order. If they're broken, you got to fix them. Mind has to be absorbed, and intelligence engaged in the disposition of service to Krishna. Then you will live in me always without a doubt. So, Prabhupada in his purport is indicating that Maharaj Pariksit had that adhikar, he had the qualification. It didn't come like that. It was a whole lifetime of devotional service. And then the circumstance of imminent death and the association of Shukadeva Goswami. So then he was there. His mind was fully absorbed in the personality of Godhead. His intelligence was convinced. Krishna is everything. Vasudeva Sarvamiti. You know the verse? Bhuvanam Jamanam Ante Yanabanam Prapadyate Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samahatma Sadurlabha. Prabhupada paraphrases that. Next. This perfectional stage is attained by a jnani after many, many births. The jnani, or the empiric philosophers, endeavoring for liberation. So this is the jnana yoga, not just reading books, but jnana yoga, cultivating specifically an understanding of the absolute truth from authorized scriptures. After many, many births of such endeavor, such persons are thousands of times better than the fruit of workers, and out of hundreds of thousands of such jnanis, one is factually liberated. And out of hundreds of thousands of such factually liberated persons, even one person is rarely found who can firmly fix his mind upon the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, as declared by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita 7:19. So, in that yoga ladder, by the association of Shukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Pariksit is now entering into that phase, the 12th chapter, 8th verse phase, where now he has the qualification to completely abandon Dharma Artha Kama, because he's already at the moksha stage. He doesn't need the Dharma Artha Kama, nor is he interested in such things. And even before he was doing such things, it was for the purpose of setting example for those who he was the leader of in his kingdom. But he's no longer in that position of the leader of his kingdom. He's preparing to meet death, and so he just abandons them. Maharaj Pariksit is especially qualified with the word Mahamana, which puts him on an equal level with the Mahatmas described in Bhagavad Gita. What's that verse from Bhagavad Gita? Mahatmanas tumam partha daivim prapratim ashrita vajantyananya manaso yatva bhutadim pavyam. So, He's on that platform, is the statement. In the later age, also, there have been many Mahatmas of this type, and they also gave up all karma-kandiya conceptions of life, solely and wholly depending upon the Supreme Personality and Godhead. So the lengthy purport that follows is passages from Lord Chaitanya, Madhavendra Puri, Rupa Goswami, and personalities that in beautiful poetic verse are describing their disinterest in all these things. Lord Chaitanya's Atleshava Padaratam Panashtamam verse from Shikshastaka, the last verse. Rupa Goswami, O Lord of the poor, do with me what you like. Give me either mercy or punishment, but in this world I have none to look to except your lordship. The Chatak bird always prays for the cloud, regardless of whether it showers rains or throws a thunderbolt. That's poetry. So, you know, the Chatak bird is characteristically one who, however thirsty, will only drink the water that comes down in the form of rain, and otherwise he doesn't drink. Although he requires rain, or requires water for existence. So he's dependent upon the rain coming from the clouds, and like that, the devotee is just dependent upon the mercy of Krishna and isn't looking for solutions otherwise. Madhavendra Puri, the grand spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya, took leave of all karmakandi obligations with the following words. This is quoted in Bhagavad Gita also. O my evening prayer, all good unto you. O my morning bath, I bid you goodbye. Not like he just went around mooching, but the taking shelter of these things for the sake of elevation, I no longer have that motivation, that interest. O demigods and forefathers, please excuse me. I am unable to perform any more offerings for your pleasure. Now I have decided to free myself from all reactions to sins simply by remembering anywhere and everywhere the great descendant of Yadu and the great enemy of Kamsa. I think that this is sufficient for me. So what is the use of any further endeavors? That's Madhavendra Puri. Again, Madhavendra Puri said, let the sharp moralist accuse me of being illusioned. I do not mind. Experts in Vedic activities may slander me as being misled. Friends and relatives may call me frustrated. My brothers may call me a fool. The wealthy mammonists may point me out as mad. And the learned philosophers may assert that I am too much proud. Still, my mind will not budge an inch from the determination to serve the lotus feet of Govinda, though I may be unable to do it. Asha Bandha. Hope against hope. And then Prahlad Maharaj, in the sixth chapter of the seventh canto of Bhagavatam, Dharma Artha Kama Iti Yo Viditas Trivarga, or religion, economic development, and sense gratification are celebrated as three means of attaining the path of salvation. Of these, Iksha Trayi, especially knowledge of the self, knowledge of fruitive acts and logic, and also politics and economics, are different means of livelihood, karma, for the purpose of even religious karma, is this dharma notion, our duty to do things in a regulated, prescribed way. All these are different subjects of Vedic education, and therefore I consider them temporary engagements. On the other hand, surrendering under the Supreme Lord Vishnu is a factual gain in life, and I consider it to be the ultimate truth. This directly connects with the message here, spoken by Sutta to the sages. What's the mindset? What happened after Maharaj Pariksit heard from Shukadeva Goswami? How did he assimilate this message? He has a very strong power of digestion. And that took in this very pure and powerful message of Shukadeva Goswami and very powerfully presented. He's now detaching himself from these ikshatrayi. He was doing them before as a duty as king, and see you later. No more. Similar, I mentioned this yesterday, similar to Bhishma Dev when he was instructing Maharaj Yudhisthira. He's on his deathbed and he's giving a Bhagavatam class. But because he was asked by Maharaj Yudhisthira, you've convinced me to become the king, now tell me, what are my duties as a king? And so Bhishma Dev instructed his grandson, or in family relation, like grandson. So he's giving him that instruction. That's the Brahmana instruction, or the ministerial instruction. Although he's Kshatriya, he's a Mahajan, vastly learned. And so he's guiding and instructing Maharaj Yudhisthira. But at a certain time, by his own volition, no more. And he withdrew his consciousness completely from that activity, and withdrew his subtle senses from those activities, and consolidated his full concentration upon the personality of Godhead. So that's the state that Maharaj Pariksit is in. But he's now going to ask about Krishna Katha. And it's not for information's sake. It's for achieving the goal of life's sake. There's no mix of motivations. As in our state, we have a mix of motivations. And it's to be expected that that's there, because we're not so elevated like Maharaj Pariksit. But it's not, you know, shame on you for having some mixed motivation. It's the means of purification from that condition of having mixed motivation. The Bhagavatam is for the Mahabhagavata, and is for the most sinful of living entities on earth in this age of Kali, and all the rest of everybody that's in between. But we should understand in the sequence of things that was outlined earlier, where are we? And where do we want to go to? And how are we going to get there? So this is instruction to help us understand where we are, where we want to go, and how we're going to get there. And, you know, having a role model, an exemplary personality like Maharaj Pariksit is very, very helpful. We can learn from him and become inspired by him to help propel us to that stage. We're almost done with the purport. The whole matter is concluded in Bhagavad Gita 2.41 as Vyavasayatmika Buddhi, or the absolute path of perfection. Now that's Chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. Yavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kuru nandana bahusha kayanantasya unayo vyavasayinam. In a short phrase, buddhi yoga, the intelligence engaged in me, mind fixed upon me stage, this topmost stage, described later in the 12th chapter, or exemplified by Maharaj Pariksit right here, this is the qualification. When that we're following, by Prabhupada's very merciful direction, we're following that process that takes us to that place. Now, we're not there, but we should know with great clarity, he's not taking us through this gradual thing. Even when introducing in Bhagavad Gita, detached fruitive work, karma phala tyag, immediately connects it to bhakti. And karma yoga immediately connects it to bhakti. And cultivation of knowledge immediately connects it to bhakti. He's giving us that, at every step, bhakti connection. It's on the strength of proper hearing, and then chanting, and then assimilating. Small thing. Putting into practice. So it's essential that we get the basic understanding sorted out correctly, but that, you know, an academic person can do. Where this isn't an academic process. This is a process of devotional service, you can say, application, and it's both internal and external. It's not just behaviors, it's developing this attitude or aptitude, that's this strong hankering to achieve that position where our consciousness is absorbed in Krishna. Our intelligence is always considering how to enhance the enjoyment of Krishna, not how the intelligence is always engaged in considering how to increase sense gratification. And that tendency is baggage that we all carry. We're trained up in a society that is heading full speed ahead towards sense gratification. And a wonderful means to achieve that is economic development. Go. And our intelligence is trained up. We've been, you know, gone through compulsory education and higher voluntary education, getting our intelligence trained up to work like that. And now Krishna consciousness is saying, hold on just for a moment here. Where's this taking you? And, you know, the intelligence doesn't quite get it because we know where we're going. We're going to La La Land, where it's going to be, we're going to enjoy. And we'll have things that will make us enjoy. And so, of course, devotees have pressed the pause button. But the intelligence is still highly geared towards approaching the message of devotional service like it's information technology. It's like a mechanical process. You put this together with that, you press a button, and poof, Krishna consciousness. It's not a mechanical process. It's a process of submission to the personality of Godhead through sound vibration. And then taking that sound vibration and, you know, going and fixing your software program. Or just, you know, deleting and putting on a new software program called devotional service. It's a whole other way of looking at things. Of what is happiness and what do I really want from life and, you know, what's it all about? It's a whole other program, a whole other approach. So it's hard for our very conditioned mind and intelligence to get it. And, you know, plus this major factor that we're in the material world because of rebelliousness towards Krishna. We got a fundamental attitude problem towards Krishna. That's why we're here. And then all this conditioning. And it's really tough. And this, just like the description we're hearing yesterday in the discussion, you go to the workplace and this, you know, it's maha passion everywhere, left and right, in front of you and behind you and above you and below you, and rajoguna samudbhava, very intense. We got to be Krishna conscious with all these, you know, adversities. And the Prabhupada's language in his Bhagavatam purport, the atmosphere is surcharged with opposition. And still we've got to be Krishna conscious. So the message of the Bhagavatam is very powerful. The message of the Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva knows, because he's Trikalagya, he knows very well the surcharged with opposition atmosphere of the workplace. And outside the workplace, all the billboards and media and stuff that are just grabbing hold of your senses and taking you for a ride, promising you enjoyment and beating you up in a dark alley. And, you know, it goes on over and over again, and people still do it. So the author, Vyas, has compiled, under the direction of Narada, this literature that's the mature fruit of his realization of the circumstance of conditioned souls in Kali Yuga, and is supplying the medicine. The medicine is to be taken with great care, very regularly, with great attentiveness. And as with any kind of natural medicine, you have to look at your lifestyle and how you need to make some changes in your lifestyle so that it makes the medicine work better. I just discussed a little bit with both separately, with three persons. Niranjan Maharaj and Radhanath Maharaj and Ramabhadra Prabhu all went to the same Ayurvedic doctor of some renown. And the Ayurvedic doctor explained to all three of them, they shared this with me, that the Ayurvedic treatment, Panchakarma in particular, what it does is it's designed to bring your doshas to a position of balance, but really it's what you do after Panchakarma that really makes the difference. If you maintain the same habits of eating, stress, and whatever sent your health condition into a bad state, deteriorated state, if you don't change your lifestyle or the things that you do in the consciousness with which you do them, you're going to end up in the same condition again. Just like writes the slate clean, and then you have to write on the slate. The Ayurvedic doctor I go to expressed the same thing. He took me through this whole Ayurvedic clinic that he just spent, you know, a couple $1 million to set up. And when we went down to the basement, we went to the top floor and all the way down, and said, "So here we are, this is the instruction place, and now we have everything here to cure people except the change of consciousness that they need in order to take the full benefit of Panchakarma, or to take the full benefit of Ayurveda. And so we need sadhus like you to train our staff, which then can change their consciousness and then in turn change the consciousness of the people that come, because otherwise it's very limited what we can do. We can set things up so that people can become healed, but if they keep the same patterns of their life activity and the consciousness with which they approach their life's activity, they'll just deteriorate to the same condition again. So that's not very satisfying as a physician. Ultimately, everything rests upon consciousness. And the Bhagavatam is to bring us to the position of Krishna consciousness, revival of our dormant Krishna consciousness. This vyavasayatmika buddhi verse that Prabhupada is indicating. And so you can break that down into different stages, and what's happening here with Maharaj Parikshit is some of that. Or, in the words of Sri Baladev Vidyabhusan, the great Vedic scholar, he defines this whole subject matter as Bhagavat Archana Rupaika Nishkam Karmabir Vishuddha Chittaha, or accepting transcendental loving service to the Lord as the prime duty, free from material reaction, from fruitive reaction. We have one sentence left in the purport. So, Maharaj Parikshit was perfectly right when he firmly accepted the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, renouncing all karma kandya section, all karma kandya conceptions of life. The Bhagavatam teaches us, and therefore Lord Chaitanya teaches us, and therefore the followers of Lord Chaitanya teach us, that one should anyabhi lashita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavratam anupayena krishna anushilanam bhaktir uttamam. Rupa Goswami's very concise statement of what the message of the Bhagavatam is, because again, Lord Chaitanya's message is the message of the Bhagavatam. The followers of Lord Chaitanya are giving the message of Lord Chaitanya, and we're meant to give that message. Abandoning the expectation of karma and jnana, speculative knowledge, one should cultivate those activities which are pleasing to Krishna, in the spirit of trying to please Krishna, following in the footsteps of those who have achieved that. That's what we're to do. And the Bhagavatam is in detail laying that out for us. So, devotional service that's unmixed. That's the message of the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the first canto, Vyasa compiled the Vedas that had this mix, and he was not feeling satisfied. Narada instructed him, it's because you didn't sufficiently, simply, in a very focused and singular way, describe the glories of the personality of Godhead and taking shelter of him. Do that. Compose the Srimad Bhagavatam that does that. So, here it is. Through the medium of Maharaj Parikshit and so many other personalities who are exemplifying that trait. And how does that impact upon us? It tells us what our mission is. It tells us what the path is. It gives us the means to go along that path. And the consciousness that we should be carrying while we're going along that path. And if we regularly Shrinvatasva Pita Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Nidyantakstaukya Bhadrani Didhunoti Saritsatam. We follow that path in the prescribed manner, and gradually, even our frail, little, you know, feeble attempts compared to the Maharaj Parikshit level of intensity and capacity, we don't have such qualification. We're very tiny. Very limited. Even with that shortcoming, the regular hearing with great attention of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, this Bhagavat Dharma process, will carry us, the process will carry us to the desired goal. Our mandate is, whatever our capacity is, you use it. Don't lament over what it isn't. Whatever it is, you use it in the right way. And the miracle is that one's capacity will increase, and simultaneously the deficiencies will be made up for. Krishna, or Yoga Kshema Vahamyam. Ananyas Chintayantamam Yejana Paryupasate Tesham Nityabhiyuktanam Yoga Kshema Vahamyam. Krishna will carry us across the finish line. Whatever it is that we have, he'll sustain. Whatever it is we don't have, he'll provide that. We need to be very, very sincere in our approach to receive this message that Srila Prabhupada has very kindly, most mercifully supplied. And then hear it very, very carefully and assimilate that message with great care and attention, live our lives as best we can according to that message, And Krishna will carry us across the finish line. We'll, it's our path back home, back to Godhead. And we have the association of other Vaishnavas who are similarly striving according to our different capacities. We're all striving, and we should respect that striving and respect whatever capacity Krishna has endowed each person with, and be a resource to help one another achieve that goal. We all have our frailties, we all have our foibles and our weaknesses and shortcomings. As we associate more with one another, we come to know in great detail what those frailties and shortcomings and misgivings are. We need to look at not just those things, but we need to look at the sincerity of the individual to reach the goal and help one another reach that goal by being good association and ourselves, as far as possible, good examples of the Bhagavatam's message, and take that same gift and provide it to others. This is our schoolroom, our little classroom. And then we go outside the classroom and we live our life in the home and in the workplace and in the marketplace and in the world. This is where our training is coming, and our purifying of our hearts, taking the message, making sure we got the message clearly, and living it. That's Krishna consciousness. So, any discussion? Well, it's very clear. You just add the adjective. There are certainly persons in the culture of the Vedas that would follow Varnashram that weren't accepting Vishnu or Krishna as the personality of Godhead. They would follow this ritual and that procedure as a grihastha, or as a person who's getting married, or as a person who's having a child, or as a whatever it is, and according to that Varnashram system, sannyas, brahmachari, whatever, and not fixed upon the personality of Godhead as the bhoktaram yogya tapasam. They would do yagyas, but not with Krishna as in all Vedic rituals. The utterance is there at the beginning of the ritual that Krishna or Narayan or Vishnu is the beneficiary of the sacrifice. Daivi means very clearly and explicitly the personality of God is the enjoyer of this activity that I'm now doing. Can you speak a little louder? Prabhuji has one question. In Srimad Bhagavatam, I'm going to repeat so that the recording system works and the people that can't hear you.
So, in Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami is preceded by Sri Shukadeva Goswami Vaja, but why Sri is not there?
Maybe it didn't work with the meter, I don't know. Where is their example that Vyasadeva is speaking and Sri is not before Vyasadeva's name? Where is that example? I haven't seen. Vyas is the author. So Vyas isn't writing. Oh, let's go. I don't have the volume. In discussion between Vyas and Narada, he's speaking. There he's speaking. do we have while we're looking for the volume? Any other question? Yes.
Towards the end of the lecture, there's one statement that you said, that abandoning the expectations of knowledge and karma, we should do all activities with the purpose of pleasing Krishna.
Yes.
So, after coming to Krishna consciousness, the distinctions between what is right, what is wrong, what is appropriate, what is
appropriate, yeah,
has become more clear.
Have become more clear.
Yeah, so that becomes the decisive factor before undertaking any activities or for any kind of indulgences.
Right.
But how does one change the mood towards pleasing Krishna? As of now, this is not correct.
Okay. Behavior modification is one thing. Devotion is another thing. It's taking up the spirit of the instruction, not the letter of the instruction. It's the difference between the politeness of saying thank you and from your heart expressing a gesture of thank you. So your question is, how does that come about? It comes about through the process of Krishna consciousness in a broad sense, in a narrowing it down or breaking it down through association of those that have that quality. And then through the messages of those that have that quality. The life example of those that have that quality. And the gradual purification that springs out from the heart when one sincerely calls upon Krishna's holy name. It awakens the spirit of devotion. So in a broad stroke, it's by the process of Krishna consciousness that spirit of devotion awakens. And the question that you're raising is something that I harp on like a refrain. Like, that's really what Krishna consciousness is. It's really what Krishna consciousness is. It's not just changing behaviors. I say it this way. We're not the International Society for Behavior Modification Incorporated. We're the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So what is that, Krishna consciousness? It's...
So does behavior change lead to...
It helps. There's motive goodness behaviors that it's like the example of the Bhagavatam is dry wood ignites better than wet wood. So making wet wood into dry wood is the cultivation of goodness. And then spark, that's Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu. So our devotional behaviors or practices are the spark. But we frame that spark, the chanting of the holy name, in the regular principles, which the pillars of goodness. And those are just the pillars of goodness, and there's so many other attendant features of goodness. Truthfulness, cleanliness, mercy, compassion, sacrifice, charity, penance, austerity, cultivation of knowledge, straightforward, so all the regulation, straightforwardness of dealing, all the other attendant features of goodness. But they're not going to awaken the spirit of bhakti. It's the dry wood. It can then can ignite. That everything comes down, essentially everything comes down to our hearing and chanting activity. It's an activity, but it's the spirit with which we do that activity. So then it goes into the ten offenses. It's the conception and the sincere motivation that let this chanting of the holy name awaken my Krishna consciousness, my spirit of devotion. Let the opportunity to associate with and serve the other devotees awaken that spirit of devotion. Then automatically all those things that are called politics and, you know, social stuff that people don't like, it disappears. At least it fades and then ultimately disappears in the association of those whose devotion for Krishna has awakened. Even if there's some discrepancy, The discrepancy is easily worked out when the spirit of devotion is strong. So that's what we want. And so the qualitative way that we do our chanting, and that has so much bearing on how we associate with devotees, starting with the first offense and so forth, the other offenses, and framing our life in goodness, doing regulations, doing regulative practices with regulation, out of goodness. But that's not going to, it's not going to create, bhakti creates bhakti. So our association with those that are carrying bhakti will strengthen our bhakti. So we have to be very careful how we associate with one another. And therefore I pointed to this factor that each of us has our deficiencies. So we can be in the fault-finding mentality, oh, look at that deficiency. Oh, look at that mistake. Oh, look at that shortcoming. We got our basket filled with, you know, issues with different people because of their shortcomings and limitations, rather than seeing the devotion that they're carrying and assisting to kindle that devotion. That's how we should associate with one another. Yeah. Anything else? Sri Vyasa Uvacha, let's see that. Chapter 7, chapter 6, the end of chapter 5 also. There it is, Vyasa Uvacha and Sri Narada Uvacha. Well, I don't know.
Well, I have one question, two questions. So I don't know, but I know one question. I tell him, but I don't know.
Maybe.
I ask our Acharya, then I tell
him. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. We would need some kind of commentary from our acharyas. I don't know a commentary that says. I'll give you a conjecture. Vyas is the author. So when addressing himself, he says Vyasa Uvacha. When addressing Narada, it's Sri Narada Uvacha, Sri Shuka Uvacha, Sri Sutta Uvacha, Vyasa Uvacha. He's humble. Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
There's only that.